dipping down. There is, however, additional and very powerful support in refutation of the establishment view of Hitler's end to be found in official U.S. and British documents. Oh, well, skipping not quite so far. In 1972, Dr. Ryder Sognes, an American dental specialist, stated that he had researched the U.S. National Archives and discovered a hitherto overlooked X-ray of Hitler's head and teeth that completely matched the Soviet findings published 4 years earlier. The question of Hitler's death would seem to have been settled at last and with great finality. In 1968, the Soviets released a manuscript written by one of their own intelligence operatives that supported the Trevor Roper thesis and discussed technical details of their investigation with special reference to the teeth and dental fittings of what they stated was Hitler's badly burned remains. The 1968 Soviet intelligence agent's book, containing the dissertation about the discovery of Hitler's remains, was certainly not in the literary class of the Trevor Roper work, but in conjunction with the Sognes paper on his discoveries in the National Archives, appeared to be convincing, conclusive, and supportive of the British report. X-rays of Hitler's head and teeth had been in the custody of the U.S. National Archives since 1945, when they were turned over to American intelligence units by Dr. Irwin Giesing, G-I-E-S-I-N-G, an eye, ear, nose, and throat specialist, who treated Hitler after July 20th, 1944. They had been available to the general public for years before the Soviet book appeared, and in fact had been shown in print before that book was published. They were certainly not hidden, nor secret in any sense of the word. Thus, a book which appeared in 1968, containing a sketch of teeth matching documentary evidence in public U.S. archives, evidence which had been easily available to anyone since the end of the war, proved nothing other than the KGB had its own reasons for declaring Hitler dead. All the dental specialist accomplished was to make a small career for himself out of a classical non sequitur. That's Dr. Sognes. Continuing. But these revisionistic arguments are based on logic, and logic is not particularly applicable to human actions. Logic may raise questions, but it does not answer them. There is, however, additional and very powerful support in refutation of the establishment view of Hitler's end, and it is to be found in official U.S. and British documents, most of which surfaced quietly in the early 1980s. These documents, which originate from diverse official sources, cover much of the post-war activities and employment of SS Gruppenführer Heinrich Müller, former head of Amt IV of the RSHA, the Gestapo. The first series of papers uncovered were prepared in the Berlin headquarters of the U.S. Army's counterintelligence and concerned the use of former senior SS officers by American and British intelligence. The second find consisted of the microfilmed personal files of Müller and contained extensive transcripts of Müller interviews held in Switzerland in 1948 with representatives of the newly formed CIA. The CIC papers make specific reference to Hitler's departure from Berlin in April of 1945 and general references to his presence in Spain. The statements about Hitler's flight are not speculative but specific and state that Hitler fled Berlin. Another very clear passage refers to the impossibility of using Hitler's services even in the event of probable war with the Soviets. These papers originated in late 1948, just after the Soviet coup in Czechoslovakia and their military blockade of Berlin, when there was a firm, official belief that war with Russia was only a matter of time. I would interrupt in Radio Free America 37. We took a look at the role of the Galen Organization in specifically generating misinformation or disinformation that would incline American authorities in that direction, which it did. Continuing. The discovery and disclosure of these counterintelligence corps documents caused considerable official concern in 1987 when an American investigative reporter resident in England, Mrs. Dawn Honeyman, H-O-N-E-Y-M-A-N, who writes under the name of Gita Sereny, S-E-R-E-N-Y, wished to publish them in the London Sunday Times and sought official verification in the United States. Honeyman Sereny contacted Robert Wolfe at the National Archives in Washington. Wolfe, who has a well-deserved reputation as one of the best-informed experts on German documents, at once contacted the authorities at Fort George Meade in Maryland, repository of the archives of U.S. military intelligence units. I would also interject, that's also the headquarters of the National Security Agency. Continuing. Wolf showed copies of these documents to Colonel Walsh, W-A-L-S-H, the director of the archive, who stated that while he could not find a declassification stamp on the papers, they looked authentic. Following this initial contact, Mr. Wolf was notified in writing by the Fort Meade personnel that they had no file on Heinrich Müller at all. As Müller was one of the top counterintelligence leaders in Germany during the war, this was a statement that was beyond belief. A subsequent check by an agency of the Justice Department revealed that there was a file on Müller, but that it was small, only 40 pages, and unimportant. Next, the documents were checked by the FBI's forensic lab, and a search was made for other reports from the Berlin CIC office to see if the authors of the disputed papers existed at the time frame in question. It was confirmed that the signatories of the papers were in Berlin at the time, that the signatures on authentic papers in official files were correct, that the typewriters and typefaces were correct to the period, and the CIC agents' writing styles matched those of the newly discovered reports. Further, Honeyman Sereny located and interviewed a former counterintelligence corps officer who had worked in the Berlin office and knew the agents whose signatures appeared on the documents. He stated that the style, format, and methodology was correct and met the tone and breadth of the personalities of the individuals involved. Mr. Wolf stated that in his opinion, based on all the internal evidence, the documents were authentic. He was unable to locate them in any official file and could not expand his statement any further. Mueller's personal papers go into far more detail about the last week in Berlin and spell out in accurate form the actual mechanics of the escape from his personal observations. The questions asked Mueller by U.S. agents are very clear, and Mueller's answers are equally clear and unambiguous. These statements make it very evident that Mueller was one of the very few persons whom Hitler trusted fully. In point of fact, Hitler literally placed his life in Mueller's hands. The chief of the Gestapo orchestrated the entire operation and remained in Berlin after the escape to guarantee its success. And again, it is upon these documents, the veracity of which was discussed in the passage I just read, that the article I'm reading to you is based. Skipping down, of the reason for Heinrich Müller's eventual employment by U.S. intelligence, well, obviously he was head of the Gestapo and as such had a considerable track record of working against communist agents and the communist party cells in the various territories occupied by Nazi Germany. Of Müller's anti-communist expertise, the raison d'etre for his eventual employment by U.S. intelligence, Gregory Douglas writes as follows. The one hallmark of Heinrich Müller's reign at Gestapo headquarters on Prinz Albrechtstrasse in Berlin was his savage and brilliantly successful campaign against Soviet espionage and the German traitors who had infiltrated into all walks of German life. Although the Army's Abwehr first uncovered the Red Orchestra network, Müller's Gestapo took control of the investigation and effectively broke the back of Stalin's efficient and well-entrenched apparatus. One of Müller's specialties was the turning of enemy agents, persuading them to work for him against their former masters, and he succeeded in penetrating into the very top levels of the Soviet intelligence high command. He uncovered agents operating at the highest levels in England and the United States, information which was of vital post-war interest to American counterintelligence. Skipping down. When queried after the fact by his American employers as to why he might have helped Hitler escape, note this first sentence because it's a doozy. When queried after the fact by his American employers as to why he might have helped Hitler escape, he acknowledged his signature on various documents relating to the flight, but refused to assist in locating the absent Führer. Müller said in his blunt and dismissive manner that he had given his word on certain matters and had no intention of violating it. There was nothing substantive to be gained from Müller on the subject of Hitler's fate. Quote, "It is not that I cannot tell you about this, but rest assured that I will not tell you, and put that matter right out of your heads this moment," unquote, was his curt reply to repeated requests for more information. He did, however, explain in great detail the mechanics of Hitler's departure without mentioning anything concerning Hitler's eventual fate. He also added an absorbing and dramatic account of his own flight to freedom in Switzerland on April 29th, 1945. Mueller's account of Hitler's final weeks in Berlin is at variance with the British and Soviet theories, but unlike these, was not crafted for propaganda purposes. Mueller was not under arrest or under interrogation when he covered this episode. He was being interviewed with an eye to employing his services, and his questioner made it very clear that the main reason for the long sessions was to avoid any possible problems emerging at a future time. Mueller's employment was a foregone conclusion, but his employers were not interested in surprises. And again, his employers, U.S. intelligence. When compared with the official theories of Hitler's end, Mueller's narrative was concise, logical, and completely believable. The Trevor Roper account is filled with inconsistencies, errors of omission and commission, and fabrications made out of whole cloth. It reads well because Trevor Roper was a skilled writer, but when compared with an analysis of the physical evidence or lack of it, the thesis stumbles. Mueller's first-person account, the recollections of a high-level professional police investigator, has not such verbose speculations and literate obfuscations as Mark Trevor Roper's creation. In comparison, Mueller's chronicle is far more believable and coherent than that of the Oxford Don. The chronicle is further supported by a lengthy report written on November 20, 1945, by U.S. Army Captain O. N. Norden, N-O-R-D-O-N, a special assistant to General William Donovan, head of the Wartime Office of Strategic Services. The Norden report was written for Justice Jackson, U.S. prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials, which were about to commence. The OSS had, through the offices of a willing member of the Soviet prosecutor's staff, managed to obtain photocopies of the results of extensive investigations carried out in the Chancellery area after the end of the war by Soviet intelligence. The report did not concern Hitler, but rather Bormann, although there was considerable information about the Soviet findings of a purported Hitler corpse and the results of interviews with various surviving Hitler aides who were in Soviet custody. This document, which was highly classified, makes it very clear that remains thought to be those of Bormann, who was slated to be tried in absentia, were spurious, but also were the remains of Hitler. The Soviet experts, in the purloined reports, stated officially that there were no remains or other forensic evidence that would convince them that they had found the corpse of Hitler or any of those who allegedly died in the Chancellery. Among the names of the missing were Ambassador Havel, Generals Bergdorf and Fegelein, and Eva Braun. The only human remains found were the corpses of General Hans Krebs, Dr. Goebbels and his family, and a number of German soldiers who had obviously died as a result of combat wounds. The Soviets stated that a body thought to be that of Bormann and dressed in his military tunic was not that of Hitler's secretary, and another body, initially believed to be that of Hitler, was found to be that of his double. Note the double. We're going to hear about who this double was and how he came to be recruited, and that was who the Soviets found, according to this OSS report generated for Justice Jackson, U.S. prosecutor at Nuremberg, and accessing material gained from Soviet prosecutors. Continuing with Gregory Douglas's account. After the U.S. intelligence agents had shown Mueller this highly classified report, they invited comment, and it was then that Mueller went over the British and Soviet reports in careful detail. Mueller's narrative on the escape of Hitler begins in 1941, when Mueller was advised by the Gestapo duty station in Breslau that a double of Hitler's, an exact double, had been discovered working in a local printing plant. This man, like Hitler, was a former Austrian citizen, born in the Waldviertel district of that country, an area from which many of Hitler's ancestors had originated. That's Waldviertel. In fact, the printer was a distant relative of Hitler's, although they had never met. The double's family had later lived in the town of Gastorf in what became a part of Czechoslovakia after the First World War, and later was incorporated into Hitler's Reich after 1938. Mueller interviewed the man in Berlin and was immediately struck by the amazing resemblance to Hitler. The double was a little shorter and younger and had no mustache. In the beginning, according to Mueller, Hitler rejected the idea of using a double and strongly objected to anyone having any contact with any of his relatives, no matter how distant. Later, Mueller said Hitler gradually came around to the idea, and the double was carefully trained to imitate Hitler's gestures and speech patterns. Mueller claimed that this double, the existence of whom was strongly suspected by both the British and Soviets, was never used in public except for several brief episodes just after the 20th of July attentat, and only to reinforce the official view that Hitler was in excellent health. We shall return to this double in due course, but the next episode brought out by Mueller was a request by Hitler for an immediate personal interview in March of 1945. This took place in the Chancellery Garden, according to Mueller's account, and was just between himself and Hitler. Skipping down. Hitler, Mueller went on, was well aware of the approaching end and was making an effort to find some kind of a solution. Hitler discussed leaving Berlin and moving his headquarters south into the Alpine area to continue the war with the hopes that the Soviets and Americans would eventually come to open conflict. Interrupting the narrative at this point, note that the stratagem being envisioned in these hypothetical discussions by Himmler, Mueller and Hitler was basically what eventually happened. Of course, the Soviets and Americans did break, and although the conflict between them never erupted into a shooting war, it was a definitive and a decisive conflict, and it wound up destroying the Soviet Union completely and bringing the United States to its economic knees. But note again that the eventual conflict between the Soviets and Americans is the context in which the strategies of Hitler and Mueller were being discussed here. Repeating the last couple of sentences, Hitler, Mueller went on, was well aware of the approaching end and was making an effort to find some kind of a solution. Hitler discussed leaving Berlin and moving his headquarters south into the Alpine area to continue the war with the hope that the Soviets and Americans would eventually come to open conflict. Mueller stated that this was not a practical idea because it was obvious to him that the Allies were bent on the physical destruction of Hitler and those around him. If Hitler retreated into the mountains, he would be pursued relentlessly, and Mueller commented that this would only prolong the war by a few months more, if that long. Skipping down again, Mueller then put forward the suggestion that Hitler could leave Berlin, but without notice, taking only the smallest staff with him, and wait patiently in a safe place for the anticipated rupture between East and West to occur. This solution was more to Hitler's liking, although he entertained misgivings about abandoning Berlin and his loyal soldiers. Mueller, the Soviet expert, quoted Lenin's dictum, one step back for two steps forward. Hitler, as Mueller said, was loyal to his staff and would have taken as many with him as he could. He argued with Hitler about this, quote, "It took some time for me to point out that he would simply have to reduce the number of people." I will call the listener's attention to the list for the JU-290A6 flight to Barcelona, as we shall see only a few of the people on that list actually wound up leaving Berlin with Hitler. Again, returning again to this quote of Mueller, "It took some time for me to point out that he would simply have to reduce the number of people. You see, if Hitler was supposed to stay in Berlin, and suddenly he vanished along with a number of his staff and servants, it would be at once suspected that he had fled, and the search would begin. The most important thing, as I saw it, was to leave as many behind as possible, and this was vital, to have some kind of proof that Hitler died." Unquote. The only members of his staff who accompanied him on his flight were Walter Havel, H-E-W-E-L, a Foreign Office official and old friend, Eva Braun, Hitler's mistress, SS Obersturmbannführer George Betz, Hitler's backup pilot, General Wilhelm Burgdorf, head of the Army's personnel office, and SS Obergruppenführer Hermann Fegelein, Himmler's representative at Hitler's headquarters. The name of Martin Bormann and Propaganda Minister Josef Goebbels arose in conversation, and Hitler said, to quote Mueller, "I mentioned Bormann again, and Hitler said that Bormann had been useful once, but his day was done." Unquote. I would take that last sentence with a generous, generous dose of salt. The available evidence suggests very strongly that not only did Martin Bormann survive the war, but that in fact he became one of the principal directives of the post-World War II Nazi underground in Latin America. And in fact, there are a number of accounts that he and Heinrich Mueller worked very closely together after the war, so I suspect, and this is speculation, I suspect that what Mueller was doing here was covering for his future boss, basically Martin Bormann. The notion that Martin Bormann was retired with the end of World War II is a concept that can be readily disproved. There are numerous books about Bormann's post-World War II career, Aftermath by Ladislaus Farrago, The Bormann Brotherhood by William Stevenson, and Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, being three of them. Continuing, skipping down, Mueller felt that the fact that the Soviets would find the body of Goebbels was of vital importance to his plan, and he spent much of the remaining time in the shelter trying to make certain that Goebbels would not change his mind. Skipping down again, the only other bunker resident who accompanied Hitler was his dog, Blondie. The Soviets found the remains of several dogs in the Chancellery Garden, but the dead shepherd bitch was too old to be Blondie, and the other dog was a mongrel. As a confirmed dog lover, Hitler had a number of shepherd dogs in his entourage, but Blondie was his favorite, and always accompanied him on his trips. The balance of the conversation dealt with the mechanics of the projected escape. Mueller, himself, had long planned his own departure, aware that the Soviets and the dissidents he had sent to concentration camps would seek him out and destroy him with as much zeal as they would have pursued Hitler himself. The next mention of the happenings in Berlin came as a result of a specific request from Mueller's interviewer. When asked when and where was the last time Mueller had seen Hitler alive during the month of April 1945, Mueller answered, quote, "On April 22nd, in the evening, about 20-30 hours, that's about 8:30 in the evening, I last saw him in the garden of the Chancellery," unquote. He was, Mueller said, alone except for Heinz Linge, Hitler's longtime valet, and Blondie, Hitler's favorite dog. Mueller said he spoke with Hitler, who thanked him emotionally for his help, handed him a leather briefcase containing a small fortune in Swiss francs, and a high decoration, the German Order. Hitler then shook hands with Mueller, wished him and his family good health, and left, accompanied by Linge and his dog. A few minutes later, Linge reappeared weeping and said, "The chief is gone. I will never see him again," unquote. They were joined then by SS General Hans Rattenhuber, Rattenhuber, head of Hitler's personal security escort, the RSD, or Reich Security Service, and the final part of the deception plan was implemented. Mueller's interviewer then asked a question that has been asked many times since, when the possible disappearance of Hitler has been broached. How could Hitler, how could Hitler simply walk away from his bunker without being seen? This, Mueller explained, was simplicity itself. Under the government quarter were many air raid bunkers and shelters. The so-called Führer bunker complex had two exits. The upper bunker had an exit that went up into the Chancellery, but the lower bunker had an exit directly into the large, walled Chancellery garden. This garden was heavily guarded by RSD and other SS troops, but the guards were around the perimeters, not particularly inside the garden itself. When Hitler came up at night to walk his dog, the guards and their dogs were withdrawn, and the brief floodlights that illuminated the ground were temporarily turned... When Hitler came up at night to walk his dog, the guards and their dogs were withdrawn, and the bright floodlights that illuminated the ground were temporarily turned off for security reasons. It was, Mueller pointed out, a matter of extraordinary simplicity for Hitler to go up into the garden after dark accompanied by his dog and his faithful bodyguard cum valet. No one would be near him during his brief constitutional, and it would be a matter of great simplicity, given the assistance of Rattenhuber, for Hitler to leave by one of a dozen exits. With the double returning to the bunker accompanied by one of the household dogs, Hitler's chief of security, his valet, and the chief of the Gestapo, no one would be suspicious, and when the party had disappeared down the exit steps, the guards would return, and the floodlights turned on again. So again, it was when Hitler went up to walk his dog, according to Heinrich Mueller, that the switch was accomplished with the complicity of Hitler's security. Repeating these last this last sentence. No one would be near him during his brief constitutional, and it would be a matter of great simplicity, given the assistance of Rattenhuber, for Hitler to leave by one of a dozen exits. With the double returning to the bunker accompanied by one of the household dogs, Hitler's chief of security, his valet, and the chief of the Gestapo, no one would be suspicious, and when the party had disappeared down the exit steps, the guards would return, and the floodlights turned on again. Mueller, by his own statements, which were later confirmed by the independent interrogations of other bunker occupants, remained in the Chancellery complex until the evening of April 29th. Between April 22nd, when Mueller stated Hitler had left, and the date of the alleged suicide on the 30th, there were only a relative handful of Hitler's aides and associates still in the bunker area. The last of the senior members of the regime, Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel and Colonel General Alfred Jodl, had left Berlin and Hitler's person on the evening of the 22nd. Trevor Roper later wrote that Albert Speer, Hitler's architect and minister of supply, remained in the bunker until the 24th, but Speer was not entirely clear about this date, and his writings following his release from prison 20 years later are filled with inaccurate anecdotal information that is at best extremely self-serving. The only other visitors, aside from military officers, were the female test pilot, Hanna Reich, and Luftwaffe General Ritter von Greim. That last name's R-E-I-T-S-C-H and G-R-E-I-M. Continuing. The latter committed suicide immediately after the war's end, and even Trevor Roper warns his readers about the veracity of Reich, who apparently had an unreciprocated and romantic attachment for Hitler, and whose highly emotional and conflicting statements after the war indicate an instability that brings her veracity into serious doubt. Skipping down again, Mueller remained, along with SS aides, some military staff, two female stenographers, SS servants, the Goebbels family, and Martin Bormann. American intelligence questioned him closely about the actual fate of Bormann, and Mueller referred them to American intelligence questioned him closely about the actual fate of Bormann, and Mueller referred them to Dr. Stumpfegger without further comment. When asked how many people in the bunker knew that the man supposed to be Hitler was actually a double, Mueller stated that, of course, he knew, as did Linge, Rottenhuber, and Dr. Goebbels. Mueller suspected strongly that SS adjutant Otto Günsch may have also had his doubts. The SS was completely loyal to Hitler, and all of his SS aides never wavered in their personal loyalty. If any of the SS personnel in the bunker had doubts, they said nothing, although while in Soviet captivity, Günsch said, quote, "I did not see the dead Führer. Those things were all done without us," unquote. The double, Mueller said, was sedated and kept at a distance insofar as it was possible, appearing only briefly to those who knew him with longer appearances to those who did not. In the end, the double was shot once in the head with a small caliber pistol, wrapped in an army blanket, and buried near the ornamental pond at the base of the terrace near Hitler's formal chancellery office. The expectation was that the body would eventually be found by the Russians, and therefore it was buried quite close to the surface in the hope that it would be sufficiently decomposed by the time of discovery to convince the Russians that their quest, and that of the other Allies, was officially over. The body was found almost immediately, filmed extensively, and then slated for forensic examination by the same team of Soviet Army doctors who were examining the remains of General Krebs and the members of the Goebbels family. Ever suspicious, Stalin sent his own specialists to Berlin as soon as he heard of the discovery of the alleged Hitler corpse. Their opinion was final. The body was not that of Hitler, although Hitler's naval aide, Admiral Voss, V-O-S-S, had positively identified it. They based their judgment on a comparison of known, pre-war photographs of Hitler with the remains now on the autopsy table. According to the OSS report mentioned earlier, the experts discovered that the ears of the corpse did not match the ears of the authentic Hitler in the photographs. Mueller explained that before fingerprints became a sure method of identification, criminologists used photographs of ears for identification purpose because no two pairs of ears were identical. After reading the OSS copy of the Soviet investigations, Mueller discounted two other factors brought up by the Russians, that the corpse had darned socks and only one testicle. The photographs of the ears were quite conclusive, and when Stalin was notified, he ordered the body destroyed. This was postponed until the next day. But as the corpse was burning in the crematory oven, a state-level message arrived from Stalin to send the remains to Moscow along with any photographs or other forensic evidence gathered by the military and police units. The half-burnt corpse, according to the Soviets, was put into a large box filled with ice and flown to Moscow, where various rumors and meaningless photographs have surfaced from time to time to bolster the injured reputations of Soviet investigators who were determined to prove that they had been right after all. After the collapse of communism in Russia, the successors of the KGB have made a thriving business selling allegedly rare and noteworthy documents and dossiers to gullible journalists. Now, instead of paying sympathetic Western writers to put forth their views, Soviet intelligence is paid by the journalists for the same disinformation. In discussing the forensic activities of the Russians, Mueller, who had considerable professional contempt for the crudeness of their methods, said with some asperity, quote, I told you the Russians weren't very intelligent. They aren't as stupid as the Poles, but believe me, they are not smart. I can see their personal teams wandering around the chancellery trying to figure out what the toilets are for. Initiative is not encouraged in Stalin's Russia, only obedience and fear of the consequences of failure. They lie to each other and engage in fraud and fakery to cover their lies, unquote. When the U.S. intelligence agent asked Bueller why the Soviets didn't find the body of SS General Fegelein buried in the garden after his alleged execution, Mueller said that, quote, obviously, because there was nothing to find, unquote. And he went on, again quoting, look, if you see history through the eyes of a police detective, which I was at one time, things are much easier to understand. You look at things with the eyes of an intelligence officer or an historian, and you see things in another way. We created a double, dressed him in Hitler's uniform, shot him, and buried him where he could be found. Now why bother with all that if Hitler was really dead? The only reason for such action was to conceal the fact that he had left and was not dead. Unquote. Heinrich Mueller was above all other things a very competent, cold, and effective professional police official. Although not a Nazi and in fact an active early opponent of the party, he ran the Gestapo very effectively and relentlessly when Heydrich gave him the job. His penetration of Soviet and Allied intelligence agencies was brilliant because of the extent of his connections and his intense personal detestation of the communist system. He was a natural choice for inclusion in the post-war anti-communist movement directed by U.S. intelligence. Safe in Switzerland, Mueller was approached by his former deputy, Willy Krischbaum, K-R-I-C-H-B-A-U-M, who worked for the U.S.-sponsored General Reinhard Gehlen immediately after the war. Although Krischbaum was a senior Gestapo official, neither Gehlen nor his U.S. employers had any problems with using Krischbaum's services, and his introduction of his former chief, Heinrich Mueller, to U.S. intelligence was considered a brilliant intelligence coup in 1948. Throughout his lengthy interviews, the transcripts run to over 400 typed pages, Mueller proved to be frank and intolerant of stupidity, sarcastic, and absolutely fascinating as he discussed the personalities and events of the Third Reich. One thing, however, does emerge, and this is Mueller's loyalty to Hitler and his emphatic refusal to assist anyone in tracking the former Führer for the new employers. At one point he said, quote, in any case, he did not fall into your hands or to the Russians, and he got completely off. To me, even if he died in bed a month later, that is something to consider, unquote. So note again in the last couple of paragraphs, Heinrich Mueller, who selected the double to stand in for Adolf Hitler and then effected the switching of that double for Adolf Hitler, the execution and burial of that double, went to work because of his anti-communist expertise for U.S. intelligence. His introduction was made by his former deputy, Gestapo operative Willy Krischbaum, who at that point was working for, surprise, surprise, the Reinhard Gehlen spy organization, that same Nazi Eastern Front intelligence outfit with plenty of people from the Western Front thrown in, that was incorporated into U.S. intelligence. And note that the real significance here is not Hitler's escape, but rather the people who effected his escape and who were at the time that they revealed the circumstances of his escape were working for U.S. intelligence. And I would also note here that what Gregory Douglas notes, not with the degree of irony that I'm going to add to it, but as Douglas says, one thing, however, does emerge, and this is Mueller's loyalty to Hitler and his emphatic refusal to assist anyone in tracking the former Führer for the new employers. Well, obviously, Mueller's loyalty was to Hitler, and even though he was anti-communist when he was working for U.S. intelligence, he was also apparently not real crazy about us as well, or at least he was more loyal to Hitler than to the United States. And it is the incorporation of the Heinrich Müllers at the end of the war, the forces that were sympathetic to that incorporation, then those forces sympathetic to the incorporation of the Müllers into U.S. intelligence are the forces which directed American fortunes and the fortunes of the world during the Cold War period, and they are the forces that have brought us to the state that we are in 1993. And that, folks, is the real story about what happened to Adolf Hitler, and it concludes our Halloween presentation, The Flight of the Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. as I say, the historical significance of that lies in the people who were employing the people who were helping Hitler to escape, i.e., us. At the end of this story, the military historian includes the following article from the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, March 17th of 1993. An AP story, Dateline Paris. It says, corpse wasn't Hitler's. Experts say Soviet troops lied to Stalin. French forensic experts say the charred corpse unearthed by Soviet troops outside the Berlin bunker where Adolf Hitler committed suicide wasn't the Führer's body after all. In a report published in the professional review Hospital Weekly, four forensic scientists concluded that the body was in fact that of an unknown German male. Soviet coroners who conducted an autopsy on the body gave a false report to Josef Stalin, stating that the body was Hitler's in order to appease the Soviet dictator. And so there's now an AP report that, in fact, that was not Adolf Hitler. In fact, as we have seen, that was a double substituted for Hitler by Heinrich Müller. This revealed to Heinrich Müller's new employers, U.S. intelligence, in 1948. And again, that concludes our discussion this evening. Now, all of our archive broadcast shows are on permanent file with a tape duplication company. The name of that company is Archives on Audio. That's Archives on Audio. They're located at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. 415-346-1840. I should also mention that neither myself nor the station makes any money off of this announcement. This is FYI. This is Dave Emery thanking all the listeners for their contributions and encouraging them to tune in again to the next broadcast. Until then, take care.